This week's episode was recorded before the devastating fire in Crans-Montana on New Year's Eve. Details are still emerging, but it is evidently a terrible tragedy. I'm sure that everyone listening to this episode will join me in sending their thoughts to the families and communities of Crans-Montana, the Valais and Switzerland that have been affected by this awful event, and to let them know that the skiing world is thinking of them at this terrible time.
Welcome to episode 270 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. I am your host, Ian Martin. Today, we're going to be finding out about the Arlberg ski area in Tyrol, Austria, focusing on St. Anton and Lech. Plus, we're going to be finding out about the rise of slow skiing by talking to the founder of the Slow Skiing Club. We also have snow reports from Italy and around France. But before we meet my guest today, I'd like to thank Tyrol Austria for sponsoring the Ski Podcast and making this winter's episodes possible. If this is your first time listening, you've already missed out on some great conversations about Tyrol. We've covered Innsbruck, Ischgl, Tyrol West, Sanjahan in Tyrol, and the Ski Veld and Ski Jul areas so far. And you can catch up with all of these, and I recommend you do. And it's been really interesting finding out more about the Tyrol and the Lebensgefühl, that Austrian way of life that connects them all together. Now, normally we have a couple of guests in the studio, but I have a few interviews to share from my trip to Austria. Today, we only have one guest. Joining us for her second time on the podcast, Nicole Feliciano is founder of Ski Mums, a fast-growing community dedicated to families. Hi, Nicole. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me back on the podcast.
It is a pleasure. Just remind us where you are.
Well, I am on the East Coast of the United States. I split my time between Vermont and New York City. And then I travel a lot in North America to get to different ski areas. So last year, I made it to 42 different ski areas spread over 100 ski days. So I like to say I live out of my car a lot as well.
That is fantastic. And I appreciate you getting up early in the morning. You may know that a question I like to ask my guests is, where did you ski or snowboard last? You got in 100 days, did you just say, last winter? So could be anywhere. Have a feeling you've been skiing already this winter. But tell us, where was it you were last on snow?
My last day on snow was at Catamount, which is a family-owned and operated mountain in New England. They straddle two states, Massachusetts and New York, and they got a nice dump, 8 inches of snow over the Christmas break. And it was one of the, I have my girls home from school, one's at boarding school, one's at college. And it was one of those old-fashioned family ski days where we loaded up in the car and it was just magical. Not a great big vertical, but lots of smiles and a great time with family.
That's great. That sounds like, I'm guessing you may well know Stuart from the Storm Skiing Podcast. He loves those small resorts like that. And I think it's great to experience that as well as the big Aspens and Vales and Blue Sky and Jackson and everywhere else that you can try as well. It's a completely different atmosphere on that type of mountain.
Absolutely. And I just wrapped up, my older daughter wanted to get back out to the Tetons, and we went out to Big Sky to see some of their new high-speed lifts and trams that they had put in place, and to Jackson Hole. And I tell you, I'm just as happy at a local ski area as these big ones. You know, there's something for everybody in the ski industry. And our job as storytellers is to make sure that everyone knows that there's options out there. The ones with the big advertising and marketing budgets are great, but so are those small areas as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's definitely a key part of the skiing and snowboarding experience. Can I ask you, how is the snow looking on the east coast of the states just now?
Well, the east coast has been incredibly blessed with great early season snow. You know, two in the top five right now are Vermont ski areas. Jay Peak, it's close to the border with Canada. They are leading the U.S. ski count with over 200 inches so far. And my home mountain of Sugarbush is got record snow in as well. So a great early season. It's been fantastic for families who want to get out there over the holiday. And it's been a little bit slower out west to fill in. You know, it's coming. They tend to get those bigger dumps of snow, you know, where they'll be counting in feet, not inches, or, you know, meters, not centimeters. And in New England, we just get those steadier snowfalls, but we've been really lucky out east. And my season started in November, which was, it is early, and it's been fantastic.
Yeah, well, actually, over here in Europe, November was an amazing month. Records were broken for the amount of snow. But unfortunately, there's not been any significant new snow in the Alps to report on. It does look there may be some new snow around in about a week's time, maybe up to 30 centimetres. You mentioned how Colorado's been having a slow start to the season in the Rockies. Canada around the Banff area, where James Cove reported from in our last episode, it looks like it probably has some of the best conditions in the world right now. But let's hear what it's like on the ground from some of our snow reporters. We've got Tim Hudson from Inspired Italy reporting from the Dolomites. Jen Sang from That's For Plan reporting from La Plan. And Floss Cockle, also known on YouTube as Free Flow Floss, reports from Team.
Ian, buongiorno. It's Tim Hudson from Inspired Italy here in the Val Gardena in the Italian Dolomites for your Dolomites snow report. Yes, we're naming this snow report the good, the bad and the ugly. So let's jump straight into it. The good. It's cold, it's freezing and the snow cannons are at full chat pretty much everywhere. Slopes are in great shape, and over the last few days, there's been nothing but wall-to-wall sunshine, so bluebird skiing. Absolutely fantastic. The bad. Still no natural snow. Despite the forecasts, we've really had no snow since the beginning of December, and that really is just getting a little bit irritating, to say the very least. And the ugly is the fact that the snow reports, in fact, until last night, were not showing any snow whatsoever. So the reason for me putting this last-minute report in is because I was just hoping this morning I was going to wake up and find some snow in the forecast. And indeed, there is. In about just after the weekend, we're expecting some snow. I have to say it's not a lot, but it could be the difference that we've been looking for. This is Tim Hudson wishing you a happy new year.
Hi Ian and the Ski Podcast, great to be back with you. This is Jen from That's La Plan and I'm live on the slopes of La Plan again. I'm halfway down the Sources piece, heading back into Belcott after an absolutely glorious New Year's Day on the slopes. The weather is blue skies and sub-zero temperatures, really chilly, but keeping the piece in great condition, which is brilliant news, especially as we haven't had the snow come in that was forecast initially to start falling over tomorrow and the weekend. That has moved later into possibly the end of next week. So we are still looking at pieces that haven't had fresh snow for quite a while, but they are very hard packed now, being very well maintained and groomed. So still some really good on-piste skiing. The off-piste is really not somewhere I would be exploring. The avalanche risk is 2 out of 5, but as we've seen already this week, we've had some very serious accidents, and so just because the risk is low doesn't mean that it won't slide. The temperatures next week look like they are dropping even further, all the way down to lower than minus 10, which is great and should really maintain these snow conditions whilst we wait for the fresh snow to arrive. We have seen the snow cannons knock on all the way through resort now. So all the way down into Montchavannes and La Coche, where I was yesterday, the snow cannons were all the way on into the town. So it's great to see them being used to top up the snow. The whole resort is skiable. It is getting quite icy lower down and on the cat tracks and the busier piece, the cross sections and things, because we, of course, had a busy New Year's week. But otherwise, it has been absolutely fantastic. So Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and I will see you all on the slopes. Back to you, Ian.
Hi, this is Floss from Free Flow Ski, bringing you the latest snow report from Tiene and Val d'Isère and Saint-Foix, which is in the Tarentaise Valley in the northern French Alps. Pistes are holding up well, considering the lack of new snowfall. However, they are hard pack and tricky snow conditions in places. Especially skiing into lower villages, there's a lot of artificial snow and difficult conditions. Now, the best snow still stays on the glacier of the Grand Motte in Tiene and on Passaic in Val d'Isère. Now, looking into the off-piste, that is somewhat variable. The avalanche level has remained a 2-stroke 1 all week and been consistently staying at that level. There are still persistent weak layers in the snowpack and there's a lot of windblown snow, so it's making that very hard to getting the turns in. Now, looking into next week, there will be more blue skies and cold temperatures, which is fantastic for people coming over. However, there is no snow forecast until the end of next week, which we're really looking forward to. So on this note, I just want to wish everyone a happy new year and happy sliding.
Right. In Team GB news, there's actually not much to report as the World Cup takes a break over Christmas, but they're back into action this weekend with the snowboard halfpipe in Calgary, the Madonna di Campiglio night slalom, and then the halfpipe and slopestyle events for skiers and snowboarders in Aspen. That last event is particularly relevant as we can check in on the former Zoe Atkin in the ski halfpipe and Kirsty Muir in the ski slopestyle, both of whom have started the season strongly. Next week's episode will be a special interview with Kirsty Muir. It's a wide-ranging interview that covers how she dealt with over a year out due to an ACL injury and then came back from that to win World Cups in both big air and slopestyle. Now, we also discussed the challenges of taking part in the COVID-affected Beijing Games, where she was Team GB's youngest competitor, just 17 years of age, all from her first turns at a dry ski slope in Aberdeen. So look out for that going live next week. But if you listened to episode 269 last week, you will know that in mid-December, I was in the magnificent Arlberg region in Tirol, Austria. And you'll also know that my trip didn't work out particularly well for me as I left with a broken scapula. But before that happened, I did get into Great Days of Skiing. I was really looking forward to this trip as I've always had a strong connection with St. Anton. My parents were one of that early vanguard of British skiers taking holidays back in the 1960s with the original companies such as Ernelow and Ingham's. And it's the resort that I learned to ski in the 1970s. But the history of St. Anton goes back much further than that. It's known as the cradle of skiing, one of the resorts that brought alpine skiing to the public. And I met up with Yannick Roma from the St. Anton Tourist Board, where he very kindly gave me a private tour of the town's museum. Now, you may have seen this building before, as it doubles as the chalet in the classic 2014 movie Chalet Girl. But I can highly recommend the museum. It's a great activity for a bad weather day, and frankly, for any day. They also have a great restaurant there, so you can combine a meal out with a look at the history of this pivotal resort. Yannick told me some more about the history of the resort.
I'm here with Yannick Rumla from the St. Anton Tourist Office in the Museum of St. Anton. And I've got to say thank you so much, because it's so interesting. But actually, what makes it so interesting is you just know everything about St. Anton.
Yeah, I wouldn't say everything, but quite a lot. So it's my hometown. I've grown up here. And yeah, I'm very interested in the history of St. Anton, but also in the future of St. Anton.
So this building, I think a lot of British people would know it if they've ever watched the movie Chalet Girl, because it features in that movie. But the history of the museum itself, it's over 100 years old, right?
Yeah, it's about 115 years old already. So it used to be a private villa for a German businessman. And now we are very lucky that the municipality and also the tourist board owns this building, and we use it as one hand on the down on the first floor as restaurant and on the second floor as museum, where we state all our history, how we became from a poor farmer's village to a modern tourism destination, how we are nowadays.
Well, I would definitely recommend it. But it's so interesting finding out about the history of the town itself. One of the things that you told me is that there's been a hotel or accommodation here since the 16th century.
Yeah, it was very important because a very important route was leading up to the Adelberg. So the Adelberg passed the mountain road, and they needed to have a place for replacing the horses, and that they have a little nap that they had, that they can conquer the big mountain. It was like this, yeah.
Yeah, so it was a key route for trade. And all of this happened before skiing. But I think what really comes across in the museum here, and perhaps people know this anyway, but you know, St. Anton is really viewed as a cradle of alpine skiing. The first ever ski school was started here by someone who, you know, regular listeners to the podcast might know this, someone called Hannes Schneider.
Yeah, Hannes Schneider was the ski pope of the Adelberg. As you mentioned, he started the very first ski school in the world, which still exists, the Skischule Adelberg. It's now more than 100 years old. And yeah, we're called the cradle of alpine skiing, but we don't claim that we invented skiing. But we took over a major role in developing this ski technique we know nowadays.
Yeah, because Hannes Schneider, who you know, created the ski school, took that technique of learning to ski and kind of effectively exported it all over the world. I think one of the photos here is Hannes Schneider with the Japanese...
Emperor.
The Japanese emperor. Yeah. He's teaching him how to ski,
he
right?
He was teaching him at skiing, and it also... Hannes Schneider was also producing a movie with another guy from Austria. It was called The White Thrill. And this was the very first ski movie ever. And it was displayed all over the world. And it was also a big part for exporting the Adelberg and skiing.
Yeah, I've actually seen that movie because it maybe was revived maybe 10 years ago or something like that.
Yeah, you can also watch it on different streaming platforms.
Yeah.
And we also host a race like the movie, The White Thrill, which happens every end of the season.
That's right. Yeah, today I was out skiing with one of the instructors from the ski school, and he pointed out where it starts from, at the top of Valuga, I think, and goes all the way around down into St. Anton, including an uphill section as well, right?
For sure, and just in front of the finish line, there are big or smaller hills. They're up to 6 meters high, where you climb over snow hills that you get to the finish line, because otherwise it would be too easy.
Yeah, well, I've done events like the Inferno in Murren, and this one sounds like a lot tougher because it's a big climber going up. But that's so interesting, Yannick. You know, seriously, I recommend, you know, listeners, come and have a look at the museum. And, you know, although there's a lot of history here and a lot of the past, you mentioned that St. Anton is always looking forward as well. And you said to me earlier that the resort is looking to bid for the World Championships.
Yeah, we're doing that. So we're a fixed candidate for Austria. In Saalbach, they held the World Championships this year or last season. And now we're looking forward that hopefully we get the Ski World Championships back to the birthplace of World Cup races for Super G and Downhill, back to St. Anton.
Cool. Well, I mean, it would be a fantastic venue for it. I saw the women's downhill course today, and oh my God, it just looks so tough.
Yeah, it is.
But an amazing finish area at the bottom there. I think you know, it would be great. That's fantastic, Yannick. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I think one of the points that Yannick made is that, as well as the long history of St. Anton, the resort is looking to the future as well. They are bidding to host the Alpine Ski World Championships, and mindful of climate change, they're doing a lot on sustainability. So I met with Gerhard Eichhorn, who is the sustainability officer of the St. Anton Tourist Board.
Right, I'm here with Gerhard Eichhorn, in charge of sustainability for St. Anton. We've had a really interesting discussion about all of the policies that you have in place here. I think one thing that stands out is that you are energy self-sufficient here in St. Anton.
Yes, that's right, and we're really proud of it.
That's all generated by hydroelectric power.
Yes, and we started quite early, and we have some hydroelectric power plants now. And it was at the time, I don't know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it was quite sort of visionary to go for it, because it was not very easy to bring those decisions also to the local politics.
All the lifts in the system are run via hydroelectric power, but there's various other things as well. Like, I came by train. For me, I consider it to be fairly easy, you know, to come via Zurich, but there are lots of ways to get St. Anton by train. You have direct trains coming from Germany and elsewhere in Austria.
We're having direct trains from a lot of big cities in Germany and also from Austria, Vienna. It's also possible to go for a weekend skiing with the night train from Vienna. This offer is looking more and more.
Yeah, I mean, the actual train that I took, the final train that I arrived into St. Anton on, was one of the OBB night trains. That was on its way to Vienna. I got off about 11:15 here in St. Anton. It was going to get to Vienna in the morning. And obviously, people can do that in the reverse as well. And you were telling me earlier earlier that you've looked at some of the statistics for the number of people who travel by train, and it's higher for St. Anton than other resorts in general.
The average in Tirol, a tourist arriving and leaving by train, is about by 7%. We could talk about 11% of the people, guests arriving in St. Anton by train. But we still want to improve it. You know, we still want to raise the number of people coming and leaving by train.
Well, I can certainly recommend it because the station, you know, which was built in 2001 for the when St. Anton hosted the World Championships, is so well located, and it's such a beautiful building as well. But when I got off, okay, I arrived quite late at 11:15, but I literally walked across the road or under the road, and I was at my hotel here, the Alce Post, within, I don't know, less than 5 minutes. So, you know, and it's very near the centre of town. We were also talking about electric vehicles. Did you say to me you've got more electric charger points here than any other ski resort in Austria?
Not in Austria, but in Tirol, we are on the top ones for sure. And we also started this these things quite early at the time where it wasn't very common to have it. And we were on it quite early, which now is really good.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I haven't come here by car, but something to do in the future. There's lots of ways that St. Anton is reducing its carbon footprint. I was also interested to read that you have like a biomass plant that provides heating for a lot of the buildings in St. Anton.
Yes, we have a biomass plant for a couple of years now, and we're always trying to connect more and more houses with it. Right now we have nearly 100 houses connected to the heating plant.
Gina, I love the idea that you know, more people are coming here by train than other areas. You've got more electric chargers than other areas in Tirol. All the lifts are run on renewable electricity, and so many of the buildings are heated via biomass as well. It seems that it's all going in the right direction. So, you know, thank you for the work you're doing, and I hope that, you know, continues. I know you've got a goal of 2030 with various other policies you want to bring in place. So we'll definitely be following that. That's brilliant. Thank you very much, Gerhard.
Thank you very much for your time. Thanks a lot.
From St. Anton, I moved on to Lech, which I discovered isn't actually in Tirol at all, but in the Vorarlberg region of Austria. But both resorts are part of the huge Arlberg ski area. That has over 300 kilometres apiece, makes it the largest ski area in Austria and the fifth largest ski area in the world. While there are some great hotels in St. Anton, I actually stayed in the four-star hotel Alte Post, where Lindsay Vonn likes to stay before her races. I think it's fair to describe Lech as a bit more upmarket than St. Anton. There are some extremely impressive hotels, often frequented by royals from around Europe, the Dutch royal family in particular being regular visitors. As it was, I stayed in a very unassuming hamlet called Zug, just out of the main town, connected by bus and gondola into the ski area. Now, obviously, each to their own, but I thought Zug was charming. All of the businesses I came across were run and owned by locals. I stayed at the family-run Hotel Staffeli, and that is part of the Changemaker network of hotels. They all have a focus on low impact and sustainability. I'll put a link into the show notes about that. But it was a sense of family I loved the most. So it felt like the personification of Lebensgefühl that I mentioned earlier, you know, loosely translated as the way of life that we've been talking about in this series of episodes about Tirol. I met three generations of the owner's family while I was there. And it turns out in this quaint little hamlet, there's another family member who runs a Michelin-style restaurant, which you would never know. You just walk past it if you didn't know it was there. So there was a lot to discuss when I spoke with Julia Fenneberg from the Lexer's tourist office. And I asked her about their cap on lift passes, their sustainability initiatives, the annual White Ring race, and the amazing looking Lech Skyspace.
I'm here with Julia Fenneberg from the Lechsters tourist office. Really nice to meet you out here.
Nice to meet you too.
Thanks for coming over. We've had a really interesting conversation just now, just learning a lot about Lech and Zurs and the whole of the ski area over here. I think one of the things that struck me, which was quite interesting, I didn't realise this existed, but sometimes at certain times of the year, you have like a limit on the number of lift passes that you sell to stop the slopes becoming overcrowded.
Yes, that's right. Because we do not want to get the slopes overcrowded. We are hitting the numbers like 3 or 4 times per season, mostly before Christmas, because everybody's keen on going skiing after the season opening. But normally we're very keen on not hitting that number.
The fact that you have it is really good, because Nobody wants to have overcrowded slopes. So to know that it's there and there's going to be a control is excellent. And we were just looking at the piece map just now. Really interesting circuit called the Weisse Ring, the white ring. And you were telling me that, you know, anyone can do this circuit, but there's a race that takes place in January.
Yes, right. So on the 17th of January, there's the race. It's one of the most famous races that we have here in Lech. And all the parts of Lech, Zürs and Zug are part of the White Ring, the race.
Yeah, so you can start it if you want to ski the circuit at any of the points. You can start it in Zug or Zürs or Lech. And roughly how long would it take you, the circuit?
Well, that depends on your condition, if you're a good skier or not. And sometimes some parts are closed, depending on the conditions, to be honest. So last year we skipped the Madloch, for instance, because it was too slippery. And not only professionals can do it, so safety is very important to us.
So when you come to the race, how many people take part in that race?
Well, over 1,000.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Okay, a big day out. But, you know, if you're a good intermediate skier, you could do this, you could enter if you wanted to, right?
Yes, if you're a good intermediate skier, you can do it. As a beginner, I won't recommend.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Another thing we talked about was the sustainability side of things in Lech Zürs. And you mentioned to me a couple of things. Firstly, that the lifts are predominantly run on renewable energy. Is that from hydroelectric power?
Yes, as well. So we use hydroelectric and we use a biomass system. Almost 99% of all cable cars and lifts are running by renewable energy.
And you've got some new electric buses, which like arrived yesterday or something like that, right?
2 days ago, yes. They were supposed to come in January, but they arrived earlier.
So yeah, that's very rare that things arrive in advance before you think. So I'll have to look out for one of those later, because one of the things I'm hoping to do is to go into town and take one of the buses up to this amazing piece of artwork that you were describing called the Sky Space. I will go and look at it myself. I don't know if it's possible. Maybe you can try and describe what we're talking about here. It's not a sculpture, is it? It's a kind of piece of art.
It's a piece of art, exactly. It's located in Oberlech because it was the best place to be. And it's an artwork, a light artwork by James Turrell, which is a famous American artist. And there are only around 50 in whole Europe, and one is located here in Lech. And the artwork is made by artificial light and natural light. So it works best at sunset. And it's open. It's an open shape.
It's kind of like a sort of donut as far as I can see.
Yes, right. Yes, I wouldn't describe it as a donut, but
it's a circle with a hole in the middle.
Getting hungry now,
so, yeah. So it's lit from the inside, and what you see on the outside is a sky that has no pollution in it, with really, you know, clear air.
Exactly, exactly. And by sunset, you can see all the different shades of blue at the ceiling. This optical illusion. It's really impressive.
Cool. Well, you know, I'm going to try and go up there later. I don't know if it will be at sunset, but I definitely am intrigued and would like to go and have a look at it. That's brilliant, Julia. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Also in Lech, I was lucky enough to meet Angelica Kaufman. Now, Angelica is a skiing polymath. She is, among other things, a mountain guide, a ski guide, a peace basher driver, and an avalanche blaster. Now, that's a lot of interesting topics to cover, but I don't get to meet many avalanche blasters, so I quizzed her on what it's like setting off explosions in the snow.
Right, I'm here with Angelica Kaufman in Lech, or actually in Zug,
a little
suburb of Lech, which you mentioned to me. You know, lots of your family live in this area. And actually, we're going to talk about family. But yeah, I'm really interested. We just had this fantastic discussion about your role, and your role is doing blasting, you know, on the mountains for the avalanches. I think listeners probably... Now, they probably have heard blasting going on, you know, after a heavy snowfall, and they might wonder about it. You're one of those people, you know, who does it. So I guess let's just start off with, you know, what sort of time do you have to kind of get up and get on the mountain to be able to do this?
So, I mean, it's an early bird action. So we meet at the chairlift around 7:45 to get up with the first chairlift. So with the first chairlift for the people who run the resort.
Yeah.
And we are allowed to go up with them. And then we pick up our stuff, our equipment for the bombing and the blasting. And then we go on the very top of the mountain. On the very top of the mountain, we actually get the real bombs. So we have different stations.
Right.
And then we start our mission.
Typically, this is in pretty bad weather because that's why you need the blasting. Yes. So you can have all conditions when you're up
there. It's like most of the time it's awful. It's harsh. It's like really you have the wind blows in your face. It's freezing cold. It's like you can't see a meter in front of you. You know where to go, but sometimes you really feel where you go because you fall over, you have to make the track. It's like really, really exhausting. So before I start my real work, I'm already sweating for 1.5 hours and totally wet. I start my day as a ski guide.
Okay. So, I mean, it kind of sounds like already that's quite challenging because evidently you're in an area where you need to make things safe. And there's several different ways of doing it. Some of the blasting is remote. People have probably seen the pipes that come out. I think you said to me you've got some machines that you can set off. But the blasting you're doing is manual.
Yes.
You've got, what, sticks of dynamite?
Yes, it's like 2.5 kilo is one stick of dynamite. And you have, like, it depends on the situation and the area you are and how many people we are. But we are always try to be in groups of two. And we have, like, 2 to 5 to 6 of these 2.5 kilos in our bag. And then we make our way through the resort and try to secure the hotspot.
I mean, that is pretty heavy. I'm visualizing, you know, 2.5 kilos of dynamite. Do you have to, like, literally light a fuse, or how do you ignite
it? I mean, it's electric. You have, like, a machine you have with two buttons, and these two buttons you have to put in, like, 3 seconds after it, and then you have, like, the lightning, and then you have, like, 2 minutes to throw it, to point it, and then to go away.
Yeah.
Yes.
To go away. And hopefully that
would be
good. That sets off the avalanche. And I mean, I think maybe it's useful just to clarify, you know, why you do that. Because I think a lot of the locations you were saying to me, what you're really trying to do is to make the piece safe. So that, you know, if there's any threat of an avalanche from a slope that's above them, you want to make sure that's taken care of.
Yes, that's safe, that it is safe and that it is down. Because we have a lot of little kids. We have a lot of people in our resort and they just want to enjoy a great day. Even if it's not a bluebird day, but they just want to enjoy the resort and we try to make it safe.
And I think one of the interesting things as well, we were talking, and this cropped up in some of my conversations in St. Anton as well, that as we've seen the area, which was originally agriculture, you know, mainly farmers. And, you know, I've been here in the summer and I've watched people like threshing the grass, you know, to make it into hay. But actually, that's really important, that side of things, keeping the grass short. Because if the grass gets longer, then that makes it more likely for avalanche conditions.
Yes, because it's easier for the snow to slide down. If you have like a long grass, it's easy to slide down. Huh? And if the grass is short, you have like more traction.
So it's interesting, you know, how things have changed like that. I think because, you know, there are fewer cattle on the mountain, fewer farmers who are threshing, it makes it even more important that you have those avalanches. I guess I'm also really interested in it. It's like, you know, you're a guide, you know, during the day, you take skiers out. You said, you know, you do 1.5 hours of work before your work starts. So what led you to this? You know, why are you one of the specialists who's throwing dynamite off the mountain?
I mean, my father was into this and I found it like really fascinating what he's doing in the morning. And I just asked him, hey, can I join you? And he said, yeah, just come with me.
Take your kid to work day.
Yes. And for me, you know, it was like adventure, you know, going with my father for the avalanche blasting. It was like, oh, whoa, what's going up there? And so I really liked it. And I thought, okay, let's do this. And the summer, I joined the course.
Cool. And how many years ago was that now then?
Oh my God, that's a lot of years ago. I would say it's around 15, 16 years ago.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, on behalf of all of the skiers, yeah, you know, who get to enjoy skiing around Lech and Zurs and the Arlberg,
yeah,
thank you very much to you and your team for getting up early and making it safe for us. That's fantastic.
It's a pleasure.
Fantastic, Angelica. Thank you very much.
Now, if you've been listening to all of our Tyrol episodes, you'll know there are some amazing local dishes you can try all across the Tyrol. I've heard so much about Kaiserschmarrn. I finally got to try it in St. Anton at the Sennhütte. That's a little bit higher up the beach from the Moserwörth. And the following day, I tried Grostel at the magnificent Verwallerstube at the top of Galzigbahn. And when I was chatting with Yannick from St. Anton, however, he told me there is another, even more special local dish that you should definitely try if you're ever offered it.
When we were talking earlier, we talked about the dishes from the region, etc. And I mentioned today that I'd tried Kaiserschmarrn for the first time. But you said to me there's another dish that is very rarely served, that really is the speciality.
Yeah, it's a very special dish here. You can't find it in any restaurant. It's because it's a very local dish. It's also all about our history and tradition from the farming and agriculture what we had here in St. Anton and in Tyrol, and it's called Wassermus. And normally you don't get that at the restaurant, you get that from your grandma. So it's a very special dish. I only had it 3 times in my life, but if you have the opportunity to get that, don't wait. Just go there and eat it. It's just perfect.
And this is really that link with the history that we're talking about, because this is a sort of dish that, you know, before, when people were mainly involved and working in agriculture and on farms, they would have a Wassermus. Just tell me what it is.
Yeah, it's only flour, water and mountain cheese, and that's it. And it's made in a pan, and normally you share it. So you put the pan in the middle of the table and everyone gets a spoon, and then you can eat it.
Cool, fantastic. Well, you know, listeners, maybe you'll never have the opportunity to do that, but if you happen to be staying with a family and granny's around, you know, maybe you should ask
her. Yeah, maybe.
That's great.
Well, that was really interesting, and I hope that's given you a taste for the Arlberg region, St. Anton and Lech. If it's okay, I'd like to turn to you now, Nicole. Now, in episode 225, just over a year ago, you joined us to share the results of your Ski Mum's happiness survey, and that was really interesting. There were lots of learnings there, I think, for ski resorts to kind of understand the market. But over that last year, you've developed your thoughts on skiing further, and earlier this year founded the Slow Skiers Club. And I wonder if I could ask you what prompted that.
Great question. I took a trip to Portillo, Chile this summer with my husband, and we had beautiful conditions. They had some fresh powder and then plenty of bluebird dates. And I asked him to get a little bit of video of me to put up on social media. And I was looking at the video over lunch, and I was like, "Oof, I'm skiing so slowly in this video." And it was uneven terrain, to be fair, and it was fairly steep. And I remember what it felt like to be skiing. I was very happy. I was very in the moment. I was having a great time. But then I was looking at the video. I was like, "Oh, painfully slow." And I posted a video from Portillo. Just said, you know, enjoying the views, taking it slowly, and that's basically the idea. Was it's okay. I'm giving myself permission to go at my own speed. And the reaction absolutely blew me away. Hundreds of thousands of people chimed in with support and their own views. I did have, you know, one or two people said, you know, if you just pole planted, you know, further here or there, you'd speed up. Totally missing the point. The point was that I was locked into the joy of the moment and trying to give other people permission to ski at whatever pace delivered the maximum happiness for them. And it really got me thinking, the response to this simple post and simple concept really got me thinking that maybe some of the ski areas and the industry are missing the point for some of us.
Sure. So that video went viral, and I don't know who came up with it first, but I do like that phrase, slow is the new fast. That's your idea as well, I take it.
That was my idea. You know, it may have been fueled by a pisco sour. I'm not positive, you know, down in Chile. But It felt great, the skiing and the Pisco Sour. And I wanted to tap into that feeling.
Well, I mean, there is a sense of irony, I think, perhaps here, as I'm currently sitting with my arm in a sling due to falling while skiing, presumably too fast. And just to clarify, there were no other people involved, no obstacles. I think my ski release because I was skiing, well, too fast. So tell us, Nicole, then, why does slow skiing matter then?
Well, I want to be very clear. Slow skiing does not mean bad skiing or incompetent skiing or unsafe skiing. It is about being really mindful. And one of my favorite things about skiing is that you're in the mountains, you're out on snow, and you're disconnected from all the other things that are trying to grab your attention. I feel more present when I'm skiing than when I'm doing just about any other thing because I'm not distracted. And maybe you can do that quickly, but for me, going at a pace where I'm still able to really observe my surroundings and to a degree focus on my technique really is the point of slow skiing to me, where I am mindful of what I'm doing and where I am.
I do find that when I'm skiing, that mindfulness that you're talking about, I think where I feel that most actually is when I'm paddleboarding out on the English Channel here in Brighton. Yeah, we're on those days when it is flat enough and you can go out and there's nothing else to think about. Just, looking at the water in front of you and looking at the pier in this case or back at the beach, etc. But that type of mindfulness is very important. But I think one of the points that you're making in relation to the Slow Skiers Club and that kind of movement, slow is the new fast, is that there are actually valid commercial reasons for resorts to take this into account as well.
Absolutely. So I saw the response coming in, and we have this private Facebook group of women. There's 17,000 women in this group. It's super active, and it started a little side chat. It's sort of similar to Reddit or any other chat group. And we were talking about, you know, often being the last one down in the family, or the one who's the caboose on the train when you're out skiing. And I was trying to tap into that joy and really celebrate the fact that they're still out there, because we do see women drop off. And this is really where it dovetails nicely into what I was talking about with this happiness survey that I did the previous year, is that we need to reflect all different types of skiing in the media that we are presenting to the ski community. We do see a lot of fast, extreme, very accomplished skiers. And I get as excited about that as the next person. What I would love to see more is of this mindful skiing and, focused on making perfect turns and taking in the views. And these ski areas are set in some of the most spectacular areas in the world. And why race by is my point.
And it's very interesting to hear you say that, because actually we were talking in the green room earlier about a panel I moderated at Listex. And one of the things we were talking about why women and ethnic minorities and disabled skiers often feel excluded, is because they don't appear in the marketing for the sport, which is very focused on what you're saying there, the speed and the performance side of things. And, a factor that I read, I think, in a presentation that you put together, noted that the median age for skiers is going up. Skiers are becoming, let's say, more mature. It's a maturing market. And so we need to consider people aren't going to go as fast when they're older as they were when they're younger. So it's important for the industry to consider how they're going to cater for slower skiers as well.
Absolutely. And when we're looking at the results, we made a survey. It was a short one, 10 questions. We know people tend to lose enthusiasm after that. And we had 1,000 people start the survey. And what we found was something the industry needs to know. 82% of skiers said they would stay longer and spend more money on the mountain if there were more slow-friendly places on the mountain. So that's pretty powerful. And I will share one of the quotes from the participants in the survey. And she said, "I'm slow, but I love gear and I spend money on it. And I spend money on specialty lessons and workshops, especially those geared towards women." So we need to be realistic that a lot of these women, let's say they're 30 plus, 40 plus, they're from a higher earning bracket and they do have money to spend in the shops on the lessons and in the programming. And we all just need to be aware of it and meet them where they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really interesting. I have read through some of the results of the survey, and I think it was really interesting, the results talking about the number of people who would like to have slow skiing zones and for the industry to reduce the pressure to ski faster.
Again, slow skiing can really help you when you're learning, as we know. So when there are those slow areas, and also the traffic, making sure, I was just at Jackson Hole, beautiful mountain, but early season, the extreme skiing, so your advanced skiing, funnels right through the beginner area at the end. So there's limited beginner terrain at Jackson, even when they're 100% open, but early days, there was rather limited terrain. And I would see these beautiful skiers coming down and they're, you know, dodging in and out of the mountains, making in and out of the runs, making like little jumps. And for a new skier, that can be absolutely terrifying to see somebody pop out in front of you. I think most of those skiers were in control, but the point is that they're affecting the experience of somebody who's skiing at a much slower speed. I think there's enough space for all of us, but we need to be mindful.
I think a difference between skiing in Europe and skiing in North America, as I understand it, I've only skied in a couple of resorts in North America, is that the ski patrol are much more likely to clamp down on what you might call reckless skiing. Would you agree with that?
I have seen mixed results. I see a fair amount of signage that says family zone or slow. I don't see a lot of policing of that. You know, I think that the ski areas are stretched a little thin, as everybody is when it comes to staffing. I think Ski Patrol's priority is getting people out of trouble, not necessarily preventing the trouble from occurring in the first place.
I mean, it's really interesting that you did this survey, because regular listeners will recall that in episode 229, I was joined by Kimberly Kay and Dr. Carol Porter. They were sharing the results of the FEAR Project, which is their study into why so many women stop skiing earlier than men and how to address that. Now, I actually happen to know that you spoke to Kimberly and Carol on your own podcast, the Ski Moms podcast. It feels like there's a big crossover with your findings.
Absolutely. And that confidence that we want skiers to feel, that's going to bring them back for multiple days, that's really important. And you know, Kimberly and Carol were talking about, you know, coming back after an injury or a fall and what you could do. They had a lot of very specific practices that you could put into place. And we were talking about women's groups and lessons geared towards making you feel more confident in a variety of situations. And those were two of the solutions that we came up with. You know, some of the other things that women were looking for were signage, of course, and they were looking for celebrations of the slow skiing in marketing and in programming as well. And not everybody wants to get faster, which is also fascinating. You know, some people are really happy, beautiful skiers. And we've talked to so many, I've heard so many stories of people skiing in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and they want to keep going. And they know that they've got to probably pull off the accelerator a little bit in order to preserve those ski days.
It was really interesting listening to you talking to Kimberly and Carol, because I know them pretty well. I also listened to an episode that you did where you were chatting with friend of the podcast, Shemi Alcott. You know, Shemi is always so positive about making sure that, you know, mums keep skiing. And I think a point that you made in your survey is that, you know, mums are nurturing their families and beginners, as the kids always are. I mean, they need to go slow to start off with, and they need to have their company with them. And that's an important part of it as well.
Yeah, and we're putting so much time and energy into getting the kids up and running. And then there's that day, you probably remember it, where suddenly the kids are faster than you. And then you are the slowest skier in the family. And it's a success, but it's also a moment of observation and a little bit of, oh no, now I am the slowest skier. I'm so proud of these kids that they've acquired these skills, but now they're waiting on mom, and you can see it in their faces. And I'm sure you've seen it on the mountain, those little, you know, the hands on hips and come on, mom, we got to get going. And yeah, it's a shift And I want to encourage women and men who are the ones who showed up and brought those kids to lessons and help them acquire skills and get fast, then to reinvest that energy in themselves. And Shemi did talk about that, that she opened up her camps and clinics to the parents because these little rippers were suddenly, you know, screaming down the mountain and the parents couldn't keep up with them. So I completely agree. Investing in your own skiing was a big takeaway from our conversations.
Yeah. And scrolling through your Instagram, I noticed you've established a couple of rules for the Slow Skiers Club. The first rule, slightly different from Fight Club. First rule is you always talk about Slow Skiers Club, right?
Yeah, we want as many members. This is not an exclusive club. We want as many members as possible. And we want, you know, I think it's your mission as well. It's just to celebrate all the different types of skiers. Maybe it is dry slopes, or maybe it is skiing, you know, a family operated enterprise, but it's really important that we make everybody feel welcome.
Well, I think that's a really good way of summarizing it. Essentially, I mean, we do celebrate our racers, but we're not all racers, and skiing itself isn't a race. It's a leisure activity. You know, it always has been for me about enjoying being in the mountains, you know, soaking up those views. And it's a very sociable thing, typically. You're much more likely to be skiing with other people. So the speed is less important. So I really appreciate that, Nicole. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put links to all of the different things we mentioned in the show notes there, and people can find out more about the Slow Skiers Club from that. Great. Well, we're just going to move towards the close now. Listener, if you've enjoyed this episode, or even if you didn't like it, I'd love to know. You can leave me a comment on Spotify, Instagram, or Facebook. Our handle is @skipodcast, or you can drop me an email to skipodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us on WhatsApp for exclusive material released ahead of the podcast. Look in the show notes for that link. We have had a bit of feedback since the last episode. Judy Matthew said, thank you for all your wonderful work. Really been enjoying the podcast. Thank you, Judy. Colin said, 267 was another great episode. I've been considering a trip to San Jose, and Lavinio is already on my wish list. Chris Weir contacted me via Spotify. He said, thanks for the podcast and wishing you a speedy recovery. Appreciate that, Chris. And Sasha Rizantsev, hope I've got that right, also sent me a very kind message about my injury. I appreciate that, Sasha. Thank you. There are now 288 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. And when I looked this morning, the stats say that 154 of those were listened to in the last week alone. So if you would like to get some insight on a particular destination or the latest kit, just go to theskipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to listen to. I can also tell you that in the last week, around half of our listeners were in the UK, around 20% were in the States, and everyone else was spread as far and wide as Macedonia, Congo, and Nepal. If you'd like to help the podcast, there are three things you can do. You can follow us or subscribe. You won't miss an episode. And you can give us a review on Apple Podcasts or leave a comment on Spotify, as Chris did. And if you're booking ski hire this winter, don't forget that you can get an additional discount if you use the code SKIPODCAST when you book at insportrent.com. There's a link in the show notes you can take, and your discount will automatically be applied. Right, for now, I would like to thank Nicole for joining me today. Thank you, Nicole.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. And thank you for telling all these great stories each week.
I appreciate that. And genuinely, I really do enjoy it. Of course, I'd like to thank Tyrol for sponsoring the podcast and for organizing my trip to St. Anton and Lech. And finally, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until the next time, goodbye.